Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to the Nat Coombs Show on ESPN in association with Betfred. Well, as the great OCU Manura would say, here we are, gang, at the end of a long old season that we didn't think we were going to necessarily see. We certainly didn't think it was going to finish on time, but the NFL have pulled it off, and what a way to wrap things up. What a fascinating Super Bowl 55, a game I don't think anybody saw coming. One-way traffic from start to finish. An absolutely devastatingly powerful performance from the Tampa Bay Bucks. And Tom Brady has done it again. Silenced the critics once again. His seventh Super Bowl ring. An unbelievable achievement. There is so much that we've got to break down and work out how this has happened. So we'll get straight down to business. And who else but the brilliant Iron Mike Carlson to steer us through. I'm Mike Carlson in the house off the back of another vintage broadcast performance. You know, this time last year, Carlson, we were having brekkie post Super Bowl 54 in a late brekkie, albeit in Miami. A year on, not quite as glamorous surroundings, but it's still very good to see you nevertheless.
Yeah, and it was great to be doing the game. And to be honest, I thought we did it really well because it was a good game to analyze. And it's always nice to be working with OC and Jason and Chappers back. And they've got such a good rapport from all the shows they've done together that, you know, it's like I'm like Zeppo Marx there.
I think you're more Gummo.
But yeah. Well, no, Gummo's a bit taking it a step too far. I mean, I tend to, in that situation, I tend to think of myself as Groucho, but you know.
Yeah, I've often thought of you as Groucho. So let's start. Brady getting his seventh ring. Mahomes, the biggest defeat of his NFL career. It was a one-sided affair and then some, which I don't think anybody saw coming. I know you picked the Bucks, Mike, and everything that you were calling about the game plan played out. The offense hummed. Brady was solid. He protected the ball. Playoff Lenny stepped up. Gronk was clutching the big game once again. But it was Todd Bowles and the Tampa D that were the stars of the show. Tell us how they did it.
Yeah, and oddly, in my betting column, it was the under, Tampa, and Gronk to score a touchdown were my three bets. So that was all right. How did Tampa's defense do it? Was by establishing domination up front primarily. And that was not just Jason Pierre-Paul and Shaq Barrett, but it was the middle of the line, especially when Vita Vea was in there. You could see him just pushing back the inside of the Chiefs line, and that made Mahomes' life a little more difficult. The speed of those two outside guys, though, did help when they were chasing down Mahomes. Mm-hmm. And I think the two linebackers were really the keys, David and White. I said right before the game that, you know, if you assume that the ends are going to be a major factor against your backup tackles, which they were, then Andy Reid's probably going to attack them by going into the flat, by going with the wheel route with backs out of the backfield, into the empty space left behind by the wide receivers who are taking the defensive backs deep. He didn't really do very much of that. I was a little surprised by the play calling as it happened. But when he did, either White or David was there most of the time to keep the gains relatively short. And the only time they got outside was when Mahomes broke the pocket. and ran. And as the game went on, I think he had more trouble running, plus running was not going to win the game. So, you know, he had to look for the passing opportunities. Then
he scrambled on next gen stats, and which were wheeling out all kinds of good stuff post game. So Mahomes scrambled on almost 30% of snaps, completed his 5 of 14 and a pick on those. And the pressure that we're talking about, this was extraordinary. Almost a third of snaps, Mahomes was pressured, 32.7%. But they only blitzed on 5 of them.
Yeah, well, so that was the key. And I said that before the game. You know, if they can do that, that means that in effect, you've got 7 in coverage. Now, David and White were doing, sometimes one was spying Mahomes more or less, and they had that responsibility for the flat. But when they got the lead, you noticed, then they started covering man, or actually it was a little after they got the lead, but when Kansas City started going to Kelce up the middle, which they were willing to let them do, but he was, he's as ever, when they play zone underneath against Kelce, he finds the spot in the zone and Mahomes finds him. We talked about that on the show last week. So they started putting David on him man to man, and he did a great job of man covering him. And man covering makes it more difficult because Mahomes can't anticipate as well where he's going to be. He can't see that soft spot that Kelce's going to fill.
And that is not an easy gig, man covering Travis Kelce.
I think Romo nailed it well when they showed him standing him, jacking him up at the line of scrimmage. And most guys have to take a step back, and that's when Kelce beats you. It's the same thing Gronk used to do to guys. You know, run up to them, hit them while they hit you, get the momentum going. And so they're trying to slow you down, and you're actually getting separation from them because of their hit. And then the other key, of course, was that they started out playing most of the game. I think in the first half, it was 22 of 29 snaps. They were too deep. And the too deep got deeper and deeper as the lead increased. They were not going to give Tyreek Hill a long pass. He got one, which was the classic deep slant to Hill. For about 30 yards, but they weren't going to give him the deep play. He could have had one when Mahomes scrambled and the pass went through his hands and hit him in the head. It would have been a fantastic catch had he made it. But that was really the only time that game plan broke down, and they were helped. And I pointed this out at the beginning of the game, Carl Cheffers, the referee, his crew during the regular season, which is different people, but it's the same referee setting the tone, threw the most flags of any crew in the league. And it turned out, I didn't know this at the time, but the two games they played against Kansas City, Kansas City had 11 penalties in each game, which was the most they had all season. And what they were doing, as opposed to the previous 4 playoff games that we saw, they were not letting them hold. You know, you could hold a little bit, but if you maintained the hold, they were going to flag you. And I said on the show, they're sending a message to Kansas City, stop doing it. And, the Chiefs pretty much had to man cover because it's hard to zone when you've got Evans and AB and Godwin and Gronk and Brady. It's hard to play zone. So they pretty much had to man cover, and they couldn't do it. That was to me, that was the real difference in the game. Now, you know, it might have been if you'd had Bill Vinovich or whoever refereeing, they let it all go. You know, they let
a little bit a more laissez-faire. Yeah,
they let a hell of a lot of holding go, but that was kind of like only fair because if you hadn't, Mahomes would be dead now, and they'd be bare. I mean, there was one play where the it was JPP and I think it was Remmers, and Remmers had him in a headlock, and you know, like a chokehold, not just a headlock, but a chokehold around the neck, and then bulldogged him. Like wrestling, you know, down to the ground. And Romo was saying, well, that's a soft holding call. I'm thinking, and it didn't get called. They called on the next play, they called holding, because I think they realized exactly what they were letting happen. So, you know, if I'm Kansas City, I don't blame the referees because they were doing what they had to do.
Mike, you mentioned that the Hill drop. The Chiefs had their moments, of course, but they couldn't capitalize, and the game just seemed to slip further away. What was going on? So you had the Kelce drop on the 3rd and 8 in the first half. Darrell Williams in the 4th as well. So there's some big moments where, you know, in each case, you could look at that play 99 times out of 100, and those players would make it. So was that, do you think it was becoming a little bit self-perpetuating, is the game was running away from
it's a good, it's the a good way of looking it's a good on. Way of looking at it. I think it becomes a downward spiral. Kelce had a couple of drops that he normally catches. Yeah. Now the passes weren't as precise necessarily as you would expect from Mahomes, because he was under pressure. He was constantly throwing off balance on the run, jumping, you know. And I think the realization you have to make every catch started to wear on these guys, and they were getting hit. They were being covered. They weren't the usual kind of easy catches that you expect them to make. They were contested catches, and those are harder all the time. And at one point, I think we said during commentary, the Chiefs normally play with such swagger, and by the third quarter, that swagger was completely gone. They were a team trying to scratch and claw their way back into the game. And, you know, nothing, you know, they came out and they ran the ball, which they probably should have been doing a little more of early, but in the second half, Tampa was going to let them run the ball, you know, and they were still going to sit back in that two deep zone and, you know, and say, okay, if you want to move the ball up the field three times without making a mistake on 10 play drives, we'll let you do that, you know. And meanwhile, we're going to move the ball back and probably increase our lead. To me, actually, the turning point of the game was probably the bad snap to Brady, which he recovered, and then Suck Up hit a 52-yard field goal. You know, if Kansas City were going to get back in the game, Suck Up would have had to miss that field goal, which would have given them great field position and a chance to get in and make the game close again. But because Suck Up,
was that as long as the season?
It was 52. Right.
You know, just in terms of game changing moments, right? So we had the goal line stand, and then they didn't capitalize on it. Well, difficult field position, 99 yards it would have been, but they punted the ball back. But then the flag on that punt, of course, that was significant, wasn't it? Because the Bucs then went back and knocked in a field goal, and the momentum in particular from the goal line stand was completely in the game.
Yeah, and you know, you always hate penalties on special teams. So they had another one where Mecole Hardman was lined up in the neutral zone. And I hate those penalties, neutral zone penalties, because I always think that the line judge – on one side, or the down judge on the other side ought to say 17, move back, you know, and just get them out of that position rather than waiting and throwing the flag. You know, the same thing happened to the Chiefs in the Super Bowl last year. It wasn't a kicking game, but you remember it took away an interception because Ford was lined up off in the neutral zone. So yeah, I mean, that was a 40 yard change of field position on that punt. So that was big. And again, the Chiefs, first play from the goal line, they got out to the was it the 12?
They broke out.
And you thought, okay, here we go.
They've
made this goal line stand. They're going to get back, and the game's going to be tight. And they just couldn't take advantage of it. And Tampa, it was clinical almost. You know, it was ruthless, exactly, clinical. Right. It wasn't one of those where you can see the guys getting, you know, more and more pumped up as they go along and playing better. They were playing that way the whole game. It was really efficient.
Such a good point. Such a good point. The other parallel, well, I say the other parallel, but the other key turning point for me, which had a parallel with the NFC Championship game, where the drive, of course, where they Scotty Miller for the wide open score, which kind of put it to bed. The drive just for halftime here as well. I mean, it was just incredible to watch that turn of events when you're thinking, well, this has just swung once again from Kansas City maybe getting something going to how on earth have they let Tampa Bay score here? And I know there was some, what did you make of the flags on that play? Do you think there was any kind of question marks? Because Chiefs fans are up in arms about some of the calls on that particular drive.
Well, you know that last Super Bowl, I thought the Chiefs benefited 4-0 on questionable calls, or even worse, questionable non-calls. I don't have that much sympathy. Jason and I had an argument about that one, you know, and I said, he said, you have to defend the end zone. It's your territory. It's like basketball. And I said, it's not like basketball, because you can't hold the guy. It's not two guys going up for a rebound. It's one guy who has to catch the ball and one guy who doesn't. And if the guy who doesn't can hold you How are you going to catch the ball? If it's like basketball, it's like a shooting situation, and the team with the guy with the ball is the receiver, although he doesn't have the ball at the time. So I had no problem with either penalty. I mean, people were saying, "Oh, it was an uncatchable ball," and we ran a replay, and I just said, "Give me a break," you know, because here's where he pushes the hip or the thigh, whichever is he got. You know, and then the legs splay back, and they and it was, oh, it's inadvertent. It's not inadvertent because he got pushed. Well, he couldn't have caught the ball. Well, Mike Evans has a stride about he's 6'5". He's 6'5". Right. The ball was from where he fell was 5 yards ahead. So if he stays on his feet, he catches the ball right over his shoulder and goes in for a touchdown.
Right.
I mean, the guy did what he had to do. The defender, Breland, did what he had to do, but I had no problem with the call. Last week it wouldn't have been called.
It wouldn't have been
called. Because they weren't calling it. The only DPI they called was on the last series of the game in the pack.
What if it had been that offensive lineman that Brady tried to hit in the end zone?
So, hey, you know, ready to argue that it was a catch because if you watch it carefully, he comes down with the ball
and he takes
like three little pitty-patty steps. And I'm saying, now that's three steps. I don't care if it's like...
Was it a football move?
I thought it was a football move myself. And then, you know, I guess Dino Blandino would say, well, he didn't have control of the ball. I say, He had control of the ball. It was on his face mask, and he had it between his two hands. But that's the way the rules go. I had no problem with that. I felt sorry for the guy, though, because fat guy touchdowns are my favorite thing.
Amongst your faves, aren't they? Now, bearing in mind he was obviously injured and it came out after
Joe
the game.
Joe Haig was injured?
No. Mahomes was. And which I think might have been. You never know. I think the comms mentioned it, actually. It came out yesterday, didn't it, at some point, not necessarily after the game, but he's going to have an operation on the toe. We talked about his receivers dropping balls left, right, and center. The pressure Mahomes was under, we've emphasized, but he was conjuring up something out of nothing. Where are we in terms of rating Mahomes' performance? What did you mean? Now you've had a bit of time, Mike. How are you looking at how Patrick Mahomes and how he played?
I think it was Mike Tenier, you know, said you've just seen what Patrick Mahomes would have played like if he'd been drafted by the Bengals.
I think that's
true. You know, they've had their way a good portion of the time. You know, you think of the first half against San Francisco, where he was relatively ineffective. The first half against New England, where he was relatively ineffective. Last season, when Brian Hoyer was the quarterback for the Patriots. You know, there are teams who have defensed the Chiefs well, but they haven't been able to take the lead and then force the Chiefs into something that, you know, they don't necessarily want to do. Houston got points off turnovers to build up their big lead so that, you know, it wasn't a case of their D playing really well to go up 24-0. But it's been possible. We just haven't seen it on the big stage for a whole game. And Mahomes, the reason I didn't think Tampa would be able to run away with the game, even though I, you know, predicted they'd win, was that you just assume Mahomes can bring them back with the weapons that he has. And, you know, we talked about how do you cut off those two weapons, Hill and Kelce? And the answer that Tampa decided on was we're cutting off Hill. And if Kelsey's going to beat us, Kelsey's going to beat us, but he's not going to beat us deep. He's only going to beat us if they work the ball up the field, you know? And I was a little surprised that you didn't see more to Sammy Watkins say, you know, more.
Well, did Watkins look? I mean, he was an injury doubt, wasn't he? Did he look?
He had one catch in the game when he came in. He dropped one pass, you know. And they really are, to an extent, if things aren't going well, they become a two-weapon team, you know. And again, I failed to see why Edwards-Helaire or Williams didn't get the ball more coming out of the backfield.
Well, Edwards-Helaire broke that. Yeah, he broke that run off. And I thought, okay, here we go. This is what they're going to do. They're going to ride him. And then they needed
to use him more as a receiver. They needed to get the backs into the receiving game to put pressure on those two linebackers who to me were the keys to the game, David and White. You know, and because they were the linchpin. And the difference between the two teams, in a sense, is that Hitchens and Wilson aren't. They can't do all that they can. Although Wilson was the guy who made the stop on the goal line. Brilliant tackle. On the goal line stand. So, you know, I think you can't write off Patrick Mahomes. It's just that everyone is vulnerable. Tom Brady and Randy Moss and Wes Welker in 2007. You know, you come up with a scheme that's going to hold them, force them to play partly a game they don't want to play and partly a game where they have to be perfect or not make mistakes, and you can control them, you know, and the Patriots nearly won that game anyway, you know. Don't mention that to OC, but, you know, but it was a brilliant win for just the same reasons. You know, I think if Tom Brady had been quarterbacking the Giants with that game plan, you know, then the Giants probably would have won the game by a bit more. And, you know, it's something that we make too much of the two quarterbacks, I think, sometimes, and we expect all or nothing. The mouth clowns go to work, you know. I'd rather have Joe Burrow as my quarterback right now. You know, well, maybe you will. But, you know, look at how everything depends on the situation and how football's a team game. You know, Tom Brady went into a situation with a team that was a good defensive team and got better, and a team that was a decent offensive team and took away 30 interceptions and 12 fumbles by getting rid of Jameis Winston and added Antonio Brown, Gronk, and Leonard Fournette to their offense.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty good situation for a quarterback to move into. Yeah. And, you know, none of us thought they would win a Super Bowl. I don't even think at the beginning of the playoffs we thought they would win a Super Bowl. But I'm not surprised in the circumstances that team won a Super Bowl. And certainly Tom Brady is the center of that team, you know. And you saw it after the bye week when they went on that run, where obviously what had happened was the offense became more of a Brady-friendly offense and less of a Bruce Arians, Ben Roethlisberger, Andrew Luck, Carson Palmer kind of offense, where the quarterback is going to wind up taking a lot of hits waiting for receivers to get open downfield.
How much credit should Arians get for that? We spoke about him on the show last week, but I don't think people are talking about this.
No, I think he gets loads of credit for, I think.
Because that's what a great leader does, right? I mean, he's deferential anyway. I mean, he's even in the post-game press, as he was talking up Leftwich and Bowles, and it was all them and all his players, like deflecting all the attention from him. But that's what a really strong leader
does.
He knows
exactly absolutely to make those no ego involved in this thing. Yeah. I think they sat down and said, okay, what can we do? They were 7-5. What can we do to make this team better? What can we do? How can we make our offense work better? And they figured it out, basically. They, you know, and a lot of that had to do with leaving an extra blocker in so Brady had more time to hit. And I think, you know, I can almost hear the conversation. Look, I don't need Gronk downfield on every play because I've got three or four really good wide receivers who are all one-on-one matchup nightmares. I don't need the mismatch of Gronk unless I really need it, you know, but let him block more, leave somebody in to help me. And that really worked. We've talked a lot about how Bowles and Arians worked together in Arizona so well. A talented defensive coach he is. And I think he'll be in line for another head coaching job, you know, sooner rather than later. And, you know, Leftwich is kind of the wild card in this because he's had a very low profile. I remember him as a college player, the famous game where he broke his leg and his linemen were carrying him down the field. He was he would complete a long pass, and then they'd pick him up and carry him down the field, and he'd be in the shotgun on one leg and complete another pass, and they'd pick him up. So obviously, you know, and he was at Pittsburgh, I guess, as a backup when Arians was coaching there. So I think he's a good offensive
mind. We did a few Leftwich games back in the day, I'm sure, when he stepped in.
He had a big arm. He had a big arm. He was a perfect Bruce Arians quarterback. He was a big, strong guy with a big arm, not very mobile, and could take a hit in the pocket. So I really admire what Tampa has done, and how long they will be able to keep doing it, I don't know, because how long can you keep a Super Bowl team together as contracts run out and people
There are quite a few, actually. If you look at the, and they've got decent cap space. So, but if you look at the, I mean, the obvious ones like Brown and Fournette, I guess they've got a, and Gronk as well. I guess they're going to make it.
I wouldn't be surprised if Gronk, Gronk retired. I mean,
really?
Well, it would make sense, sort of. You know, he came back out of retirement. They won a Super Bowl. Unless he's really bored with life as Gronk. Who could be exactly? Tom Brady said this morning something like Gronk is like what we all want to be in our second lives.
Spot on. Terrific stuff, Mike.
Who said the unexamined life is not worth leading? Not Gronk.
Definitely wasn't Gronk. One more on this game, and then I want to wrap by remembering two people who we lost this week, and someone very close to you personally, somebody that was close to us and a lot of our listeners as well. But I have one more on the Super Bowl, and I guess broadly on this incredible achievement by Brady, because you made a great point that he went into a decent landing spot, and that's smart of Brady because he had, I guess, no shortage of offers. The interesting discussion I heard on the Simmons and Cousin Sal show about which other spots, if Brady had landed, like the Rams, for example, would he have had similar level of success? But that's maybe for an off-season pod, we can talk about that. But the, sure. the Tampa landing spot was good. A good side that he's helped make great. In the context of all sports, Mike, not just the NFL, how remarkable is this achievement? Now Brady's got 7 rings. Help us rationalize it.
Well, just put it in the context of the NFL. He's got 7 rings, including one in his first year with a new team, and only the second guy to have Super Bowl rings with 2 teams after Peyton Manning. And Manning had, it was a similar situation. Manning's defense carried them to the game, but Brady, I think, contributed more than Peyton did in the winning Super Bowl game. Nobody else has. He has more rings than any team has trophies. He's been to the Super Bowl more than half of his seasons as a starter, 10 out of 19. Nobody else has come close to doing that, you know. And he has been, I used to say this all the time, people would say things like he's a system quarterback. He's any system quarterback. You know, Belichick, in the 6 Super Bowls they won in New England, they were 4 different teams in terms of how their offense worked. At minimum, he could do any offense that you want. And it's hard to match him against sports where an individual stands out more, like, say, basketball and Michael Jordan, you know, who's tremendous with it in basketball. He's more like Bill Russell, who won 11 titles in 13 years. And everybody said, oh, he's got great teams around him, which he did, but they weren't much better than the teams Wilt had around him. But he was the drive to win. He was the guy who would do what it takes for the team to make the team win. And in football, the quarterback is probably the most, you could argue the goaltender in ice hockey might be more important to a team because a really hot goaltender can shut a team out and let you win 1-0. But there is no position that's more important in a team sport than quarterback. Everything's channeled through him. The whole offense goes through him. If you're going to win the game, he's got to at least be able to put some points on the board. You can win without a great quarterback. You can win a Super Bowl without a great quarterback. And sure, some of it's the coach, but awful lot of it is Brady. And to do this at 43,
right,
is even more remarkable. So, you know, I think people who are saying today he's the greatest athlete in team sports or whatever, you know, probably the greatest participant in team sports. Because I still don't think he's an athlete. It's like, he's a competitor.
Participant.
You know?
Only you on the morning after Brady's 7th Super Bowl ring.
It reminds me of John Kruk. No, I'm all in on Brady. I just looked at it was your piece, actually. It was your nice piece at the beginning of our show. When you saw Brady at the combine, in with that flabby little body, that little flabby body, yeah, right. and trying to run the 40 in less than 10 seconds, and you know, that kind of thing. It's like when John Kruk, the baseball player, was at a postseason thing, and he was fat anyway, and he was smoking and drinking, and some woman said, "Why are you doing that? You know, you're an athlete." He's like, "I'm not an athlete. I'm a baseball player." and that's what Tom Brady is. He's a football player, right. You know, and he's figured out the game like nobody has, I think, or nobody certainly since the days of maybe Otto Graham and Paul Brown being together and being able to dominate the way that they did. So, yeah, I think 10-7 is pretty much untouchable. You know, I don't see Patrick Mahomes having as long a career.
Because he puts himself in the line of fire too much.
There's that, and I just think things are going to be changing with the new generation. You know, that this generation that's been the first to kind of, for all the greats to keep going into their 40s, might well be the last that does that.
Speaking of Brady's college or combine picture, I always want to dig out as many pictures as I can of you in the college era. Big hair, Mike, of course.
I'm getting there because of the pandemic. Yeah.
It's getting there. It's kind of recreating that. You posted a great shot the other week on Twitter from back in the day. That's slightly after your college days. But I'd love to see your pick from college days and see what kind of shape you're in then. And speaking of which, and you know, I mentioned we wanted to remember a couple of greats, and one of them was your head coach from college who sadly passed away this week, Mike. So yeah, as you're reaching over to the wall, there you go. That's a picture of you. There you go. And so for the benefit of our listeners, and we'll push this out on social, clip this up as a video at the NC show. There's Iron Mike in full flight. Oh, I love this picture because it's the one with the kid in the background right?
The kid was the son of one of our assistant coaches.
yeah. I love that shot. But Carlson, your head coach from Wesleyan passed away.
Yeah, and Don Russell was the head coach for 7 years. So I was lucky to play, you know, varsity the last two of those years, in which we won the Little Three both years. We went undefeated in the first year of that. And he was the perfect coach for that time and place of guys, you know, who weren't bound by their scholarships in a time of great unrest and you know, and loads of distractions as well. And lots of us, we went on a Zoom call with him in December. He was quite frail. He was 93 when he died. But as soon as the current athletic director at the college started the Zoom call, Don took over like he was the coach. And all of these guys, most of whom were older than I am because they played for him, you know, earlier than that, immediately became 20-year-old players, you know, 19-year-old. Right. And I played my first year at 18 for him. It was great that we were able to do that. And then you would know because you were there, but in one of the games of Wembley, when they had the, in 2019, when they had the 50th anniversary banquet for the undefeated team, I couldn't go there because I was working. But the week before, I recorded a little message about that. And I was going to talk about the season, but I wound up talking all about Don and how much he had meant to me personally, as well as being a really good coach. And that got some mention. I messaged his son with condolences. He messaged me back and just said how much that recording had meant to him and to the family, who all have copies of it now, you know, and can look at it. So the tributes that were coming out were absolutely great. And
that must have been great for him to see, because you recorded that up in the studio, didn't you, at Wembley? And it must have been great for him to see, you know, you all these years later.
I think he would have found that as probably the most improbable thing of his life. that of all the players he ever coached, the one who would still be doing, one of my teammates is still coaching football at a prep school in Connecticut. But you know, that I would be the one still doing football, you know, would probably surprise the hell out of him. And, and you know, we did that. They kept putting it off. I mean, it was a huge favor of everybody to let me do it. But they kept putting it off, and we literally, you know, started it like 5 minutes before we went on air.
And I remember
Andy in my ear saying, you know, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. And yeah, I got
pushed out of the room while you were recording.
I've got something to say here, guys. You know, I told you it's going to be 5 minutes, and I was doing it off the top of my head, not off a script. So we just barely got it done, and then started the game. But
I'm pretty sure I remember just being outside the studio and OC and Jason like, what is Mike doing?
Well, they were in on it, you know, because I got them to introduce themselves, you know, and then I compared my little three winners medal to one of OC's Super Bowl rings.
Oh, rings. Yeah,
which was quite good. And, you know, being the kind of cynical person I am, I went back and looked at Don's record compared to the three coaches who followed him, none of whom ever won a single little three title. And in fact, most of whom were completely useless against Amherst and Williams. Well, really all three of them were, including the one who became our head coach, who was the Dan Campbell of my life. And Don coached 7 years. His record against Amherst and Williams was 7-7, which was fair enough because it's a tight rivalry. But he won three in 7 years, which Wesley and then went almost 50 years, 40 years before they won another one. So I think, you know, that speaks for itself as a football man.
Raising a glass to coach, and we want to wrap the show today by remembering another friend and colleague, one of the NFL family, Chris Wessling. Wes, of course, who so many of you listening will know and listen to around the NFL and have read his stuff on NFL.com over the years. He passed away this week. He was just 46. And Mike, he was absolutely one of the good guys because we were speaking in Miami a year ago. We were out with him and Greg and many others for dinner on the Saturday night. And, you know, other times, of course, because of, you know, our friendship with Greg, you know, and the circles that we're in and the world that we're in, you know, we knew him, but it was way beyond that and the personal connection. It was to everyone who has talked about him, certainly since the news broke, the tributes that have been coming in, the common thread has been that he is somebody who made everyone around him better.
I think that's really true. You know, and it was funny that we had this dinner in Miami and Greg and Chris showed up. Cause they were the two guys who made that show work. Because Greg is so smart basically, and he's so dryly funny, and Chris is very smart and not dryly funny, very funny, you know what I mean? Very upfront funny. And that right. They were to me, the heart of the show, the most interesting part of the show. And I put up on, after the meal, we took a photo outside with you and me and the two of them. And, three of us look pretty drunk and happy. And one of us looks like he's presenting the photo. I won't say who that is, but
presenting the photo.
It's like, do I look right? Anyway, but Wes, you know, it was the only time I met Wes, and we talked a long time about books, which was one of his, you know, one of his things. And we had emailed back or messaged back and forth about certain books, non-football books, but we also were talking about his list of best football books. Cause I had seen that, and, you know, he was just a lovely guy, and for him to go so soon after, you know, after they thought he was going to have, you know, another good run after his first bout with cancer. But he got married. He had a baby.
Yeah, Lakeisha and Link.
And you know, boy. Somebody put up somewhere, and I retweeted it. So if you go to my Twitter feed, you can find it. But a little video they made for the show. And it ends with Chris and Link. It's the most beautiful photo.
Yeah. Isn't it?
And to think that he's gone, you know, and won't be able to do that again. Yeah, I just hope his son sort of has it in his bedroom and looks at it.
I'm sure he will. And, you know, Mike, we mentioned Greg, Dan, Mark, those guys, and everyone around them, you know, as well involved with that show. They are such a strong unit. And those three, we're talking about this on radio last night as well. And the point was made that they are going to make sure that Link knows what a great guy his dad was, and they're going to be around him in a bubble of support, and to keep that humor make sure that's a kind of fundamental part of everything. Yeah. But also,
we'll see him. We'll see him on the NFL Network in 22 years or so.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be nice. It would be nice. It would be nice if we did. And you know, and they had great exposure here. You know, not by our programs, but they were seen in Britain, an awful lot. And when they came over, you know, on
Rockstar.
Yeah, it was great. And you know, it's just a sad reminder. You know, he was 46, Don was 93. Yeah. You know, and sometimes you get a great long run, and sometimes you don't, but. I think the key thing is how much influence you have on the rest of the world while you're doing it. And Wes got an awful lot in his 46 years.
Yes, he did. We're raising a glass to him, raising a glass to both of them. And I'm sure you will join us in that. Mike, a pleasure as ever. Thank you so much as well for all your brilliant insight this season. Love working with you, man. We're going to roll into the off season. That's when we get to do some really fun pods as well. So I'm looking forward to hooking up with you and doing some of those.
Thank you. It's always good for us to be working together, and you know, given the crazy season we had, I'm glad we were able to do it.
Yeah, we pulled it off. Look after yourself, bud. Take care. Check
okay,
in soon.
Bye bye.
Brilliant stuff from Iron Mike. Always an absolute pleasure working with him. I want to say massive thanks to all our contributors for all of their excellence this season. Really appreciate everybody behind the scenes. To producer Ol, who's kind of a hybrid now, right? Because he's the star of Edge Rush. Marley, we've got Andy and Tom running our social channels. A massive thanks to all of them. Everybody on the ESPN UK side as well, and stateside, getting us some brilliant guests through the season. So big thanks to all of you involved with the show, including everybody that listens, because we couldn't do this without you, our listeners. Love it, appreciate it. We're going to keep rolling with it through the off season. You can't get rid of us that easily. Pods are going to be dropping thicker fast. And I was suggesting with Mike, in the off season, we can get some good fun ones as well. So we are going to keep bringing it if you keep listening. At the NC Show, our social channels, we'll keep pushing stuff out on there as well. In fact, speaking of producer, we're back with Edge Rush on Thursday. Yeah, we're going to have a season wrap. Given we were so big on the Chiefs, that's going to be quite an interesting show. But hey, we got quite a lot right as well on the prop bet side. And we had an all right season. So we're going to be wrapping up the season and looking ahead at the futures market for next year. And by doing so, look at some of the big narratives going into the offseason. So Edge Rush drops later on this week, and the show is rolling all through the off season, so stay locked in. Saluting you, appreciate it. We'll see you soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.